Well, good afternoon, everyone. Lovely to see all of you here for this seminar on this extremely interesting case of Commission and Malta. It is groundbreaking. We use that term a lot. It might not necessarily be groundbreaking in the ways that you would think, but it is highly significant. Now, the judgment was now a few months ago. This has given a bit of a chance for things to settle and people would have a chance to draw breath and perhaps think in a more nuanced way about the case. For those of you who are not familiar with the case, just very briefly, because the facts at least are not complicated, a number of member states have golden visas or golden passports. And to put it crudely, you pay a large sum of money and that gives you a passport. And that is very good for the individual who is rich. It's very good for the country to get a shitload of money. Less good for those who are not rich, who are having to go through a lengthy process of naturalisation, which in the case of Malta also meant having to learn to speak Maltese. So it gives a quick route to nationality. And of course, that's the gateway to citizenship. And that was the problem in this case. The problem in this case was that there was objections from the commission. Now, this case is highly significant because we are going through what I might call a constitutional moment with the EU, because you've got a large number of significant constitutional cases. This one, you've got Commission on Hungary, where we've got the Advocate General's opinion, but not the judgment. Commission on Denmark, which is on the minimum wages, where the court did uphold largely the validity of the directive. The case on marriage, on recognition of same-sex marriage, also in this context. So a lot is happening, and I'm very privileged and fortunate to have some very good speakers. I'll just do the technology there. So I will start with those online. Daniel Sarmiento, a good friend and wonderful colleague from Madrid, who was counsel in the case on behalf of Malta. Takis Tridimas, also a very good friend and colleague who's in Luxembourg and knows more about EU law than anybody else I've ever come across, apart from possibly Steve Pierce. And in addition, in the room, Amelia Lanati and Martin Steinfeld. Now, we are going to do a magnificent thing, which is everyone's got maximum 10 minutes to speak. We've got a whizzy camera that whizzes round the room, which is slightly disorientating. But nevertheless, this is what comes of sharing with the Faculty of History. They do these things. But what we will do is we will kick off with Takis, who has got to leave us fairly soon, then Daniel next. So Takis, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Catherine. First of all, thank you very much for having me and including me in this.
Daniel, do you go next?
Do you want me to start?
Yeah, yes, please.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Catherine, and thank you, everyone at the Center, for organizing this seminar and for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's always a pleasure to discuss interesting cases with such a distinguished group of lawyers, colleagues, and friends. So this is a fun event. So very happy to be here. Commission versus Malta. This is a judgment. I don't think it needs any introduction. I think everybody in the room is very much aware of what this judgment is about. So we can skip all the introductions about the context of the case, what the Maltese framework can concern, and what the court actually said. We will be discussing about that. So let me just start by making a quick disclaimer. As Catherine just announced, I was counsel for Malta in this case. Everything I say here, as you can understand, is said in a purely personal, and I would also say academic capacity. So I'm speaking here as a professor of EU law, giving you my views on the judgment. So I'll make no comment on what came before the judgment, but I will focus exclusively on the judgment and how I interpret the judgment. I've in the 8.5 minutes I've got left, I would just like to point out three features of this judgment. One is mostly procedural. The second one is based on EU citizenship law and citizenship law more generally. And the third one concerns the future. What does this judgment mean beyond citizenship and going forward for EU integration? Lots of food for thought for 8 minutes now. Now, on procedure, this is a case that raises some interesting features, which some have been commented, some others are not. This might be a bit more for the procedural law freaks, as myself. But it is the first time that the court doesn't only tackle at the invitation of the Commission a national provision on the attribution of nationality. But I should add that it concerns a national regime which governs an entire regime on a type of acquisition of nationality. It's not a specific rule. It's not the rule on the amounts concerned. It's not the rule that determines. It's the entire framework that was challenged by the Commission. I'm saying this because in terms of looking forward, the Commission not only addressed a specific problematic aspect of the nationality laws of one member state, but it also targeted an entire full framework governing a specific course of acquisition of nationality. And that opens the way for future measures of the kind, not in a very surgical way, but in a more general approach on the part of the Commission. And this was discussed in the proceedings, but the court didn't seem to give too much weight to the fact that this was being done for the first time, and it might not be the last. A second procedural aspect of this judgment, which at least it strikes me, it surprises me when reading the judgment, has to do with the reasoning of the court. And I recommend the reading of the opinion of the Advocate General, who was who took a completely different position from the court. It proposed to dismiss the action of the Commission. And the Advocate General did fix its analysis on the actual discussion that had taken place beforehand between the parties, which concerned the existence of a genuine link as a requirement under EU law to have access to nationality. And that was the Commission's main line of argument, the existence of a prior genuine link. The Advocate General was not convinced by that approach of the Commission, and it decided to dismiss the case, or to propose to dismiss the case. The court, in contrast, construed a different type of argument. And this is something that is a bit striking, because in the context of an infringement procedure where the arguments of the parties set the scene to what the court will eventually decide and set the terms of the discussion, the reasoning of the judgment sounds reads as a surprise for those who had been engaged for almost 2 years in the written procedure discussing on certain legal issues. So it sends the message that the court in infringement procedures is willing to be creative. It's willing to even go beyond the specific arguments that had been exchanged by the parties. And in certain cases of constitutional importance, it may be even willing to construe new arguments in one side or another. Yeah. So those are two procedural features I'd like to point out of this judgment, which are important for litigators and procedural law generally. Now, going to citizenship under substance. This judgment, as you know, eventually decided to rule against Malta, considering that a scheme in which, for an exchange of payments, access to nationality was granted constituted a transactionalization of European citizenship. There are multiple angles that can be used to analyze this conclusion. The first angle has to do with the court's previous case law and its current approach towards regimes on access to nationality. The court has said for a very long time that member states have competence to establish conditions on nationality generally, as long as they comply with union law. And that is the standard formula that's been used for many years to allow union courts to have a say on certain rules on nationality of the member states. The closest case to an intensive scrutiny of nationality law concerned cases of deprivation of nationality. And you will all be aware of the case law that started with the Rotman case and continues successively with other important rulings on deprivation. Those are cases that involve individuals who are at a risk of becoming stateless. And in those circumstances, the court considered that a risk of statelessness involves also a risk of loss of European citizenship because of the loss of nationality. And as a result of that risk of statelessness, which has relevance under international law, then a series of criteria can be used by union law to determine whether that deprivation is compatible with the treaties. Now the court has opened the door not only to review of deprivation of nationality by the member states, but also to the acquisition of nationality by the member states. In the cases of deprivation, the standards are very, very close to situations involving potential restrictions of fundamental rights, of human rights. And that allows the court to undertake that review in terms that are rather familiar, let's say, for constitutional lawyers. So the court applies a proportionality test, the court looks at the charter, the court looks at international law, the Geneva Convention on statelessness, etc. Now that the step has been taken to also review conditions of acquisition of nationality, the standard is not very clear. We have one standard now, and that standard is transactionalization. Member states cannot commercialize the acquisition of nationality. The problem with the judgment, in my view, is that the reasons why commercialization as such breaches a specific substantive standard of union law, whether as a result of international law because of the lack of a genuine link, or whether because there is a connection with the charter or any other rules, is quite alarmingly missing in the reasoning of the judgment. So we are left with a judgment basically saying, I am willing to step into rules on acquisition. There is a standard to be applied. For now, that standard includes situations of commercialization of the acquisition of European citizenship. We don't know why commercialization as such is so problematic. We can imagine the reasons. And there are some general remarks in the judgment concerning the exercise of political rights. But these are considerations of a very general nature, which do not really connect the dots between those rights attached to the status of citizenship and the standard which focuses on a breach or a prohibition of commercialization. And that leaves, I think, the reader and eventually the legal community altogether in a rather difficult position to anticipate what are the kinds of conducts that member states are precluded from undertaking in the future in the field of acquisition of nationality. Nevertheless, this is an important ruling. It is a ruling that takes a step forward in a very significant way in federalizing union law, touching an area, a core area of national sovereignty. So I think that it can be easily said that this judgment consolidates the edifice of constitutionalization of European citizenship. It even goes beyond and states that European citizenship is not any longer intended to become the fundamental status. The judgment says that it is the fundamental status of nationals, of the member states, which is something that has happened out of the blue as a result of judicial fiat. That's something we can discuss later. But it's obvious the court wants to send a powerful message as to the evolution of the construction of the European citizenship edifice. Is this something that can be sustained and can be defended as such by reading the judgment? Well, in my opinion, there is still quite a lot of work to do in the field of European citizenship. And I don't think that this judgment alone can allow us to say that European citizenship is the fundamental status of the nationals and member states, nor that the edifice is completed. There is still a lot of work to do. And there is still a lot of margin of action for the member states in the field of nationality. And here I think that we should not forget that there are declarations attached to the Treaty on European Union, which very clearly stated that the attribution of nationality is something that is solely reserved to the member states. Those declarations were mostly sidelined in this judgment. And the implications that stepping into the field of nationality entails is something that the judgment does not handle or does not tackle straight on. One last comment on the content of the judgment. There is an enigmatic reference to solidarity in the judgment. Solidarity as a value, apparently, but solidarity as maybe a connecting dot between this prohibition of commercialization and the standard that the court has in mind to introduce limitations on member states in the field of nationality. There has been a lot being written, well, a lot, it's quite soon yet, but there has been already some literature and some preliminary comments made on the judgment, making a rather broad interpretation of this idea, this notion of solidarity in the judgment. I think at the moment it's a bit too early to say what are the implications of solidarity as a concept in this judgment and what can be drawn in the future. But that's something that we can leave for the debate. Takis has just returned. Since I have 2 minutes left, I will finish in these 2 minutes and I'll give the floor to Takis straight away.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, just my final comments in going beyond citizenship. What does this judgment mean in terms of the broader picture? Well, there is an apparently clear connection between this judgment and the ongoing case law of the court on Article 2 and the values of the European Union. And I think that we're all expecting the judgment on Commission versus Hungary in Article 2, maybe as a guiding light to confirm or not whether in Commission versus Malta, the values have any use to understand Commission Malta, because maybe when Commission versus Hungary arrives, that will be clarified. My impression is that there was a conscious attempt in Commission versus Malta to keep away from values, precisely because the court is now reflecting on how to articulate those values. So we might have an ex post reconstruction of Commission Malta when we read the judgment in Commission versus Hungary. It is very difficult for a Grand Chamber to make an important decision in Article 2 when that Grand Chamber knows that there is a plenary formation of the court deliberating precisely on the broader topic of Article 2. So I think that there was a conscious effort on the part of the court to keep the values dimension of this judgment on the sidelines. But that doesn't mean that the future Commission Hungary judgment will be irrelevant for Commission Malta. On the contrary, I think that we might have to reread Commission Malta once Commission versus Hungary is delivered. And one final note on transactionalization or commercialization. This standard that has been introduced in Commission versus Malta is a standard that raises questions beyond citizenship. If citizenship cannot be commercialized, what about the transactionalization of other fields connected with other, let's say, values? We were speaking early on about yesterday's hearing in Luxembourg on the Medel case, where judges bring the council to court because they consider that the council had negotiated with Poland certain conditions of judicial independence, which were below the standards required by union law. Can the council and Poland negotiate on the disbursement of funds on the grounds of how Poland is going to comply with rule of law standards? Is that a transactionalization of the rule of law as a value in Article 2? So this notion of transactionalization, we should not just look at it in the context of citizenship, because it might have broader implications going beyond Commission Malta. It might not, but I'm just putting an example here in which this idea of transactionalization, of wrong morally wrong transactionalization, might be problematic in other fields. And with this last comment, I finish, and looking forward to listen to Takis and the rest of the speakers.
That was hugely interesting. Takis, thank you very much indeed to come back. I realise the timing is terrible for you, and despite all the wonders of Luxembourg, they can't get Wi-Fi to work. But very much indeed for coming back. You've got 10 minutes.
Thank you very much. I apologize both for making all the disruption, and also I'm very sorry to have missed what Daniel had to say. So essentially, I would like to make two points. The first is that, to my mind, instead of the court imposing restrictions on the conditions that a member state may impose for the acquisition of its own nationality, what the court perhaps ought to have done is impose restrictions on the exercise of union citizenship rights. That's the first point. And the second point is, I think this, what I'm suggesting, this possibility it remains open after the ruling of the court. So let me just try and explain a bit each of those two points. The judgment is very far-reaching. I don't think there is any doubt about it. It is an illustration of what one could call the EU's negative competence or dormant competence, if you wish, to find out how much power the European Union has. One needs to look not only at the areas in which it can legislate, but one also needs to look at what the EU can prevent the member states from doing. And there is an established line of case law which suggests that in areas which fall within the competence of the member states must exercise that competence in compliance with EU law. We know this already from the 1970s. Factor Tame in the 1980s is an illustration of this. So this is, I use the gardening analogy. It's like there are certain areas, like the law of nationality, there are parts of the garden where the EU cannot plant. It's the member states can plant their own trees, but the EU can release its woodpeckers and they have a go at these national trees. And then you get the shape of the tree, the shape of the plant is part EU, part member state law. And I think the most acute manifestation of this is the Maltese case. So the court uses a number of arguments. It talks about citizenship as solidarity. It refers to citizenship as mutual trust. It uses the argument that there is an area of freedom, security, and justice, which in turn requires mutual trust between the member states. It talks about citizenship as the entry point to participating in the democratic life of the Union. And then it refers to Opinion 213 and places citizenship at the center of the integration bargain, essentially. Opinion 213 is a case where the court provides a system of EU law, talks about the raison d'être the EU, which is integration, and an integral part of this is union citizenship. And all this is used to come to the conclusion that it requires a kind of solidarity, and therefore it cannot be commercialized. That is, in a nutshell, an inarticulate presentation, if you wish, of the court's reasoning. Now, I have some difficulty with that, and I have difficulty because I don't think it is for the Court of Justice to tell the member states how they should understand the concept of solidarity, how they understand the special bond that the granting of a nationality implies. You could defend the judgment on the ground that the losing party, in this case Malta, is better able to absorb the adverse consequences of the ruling. What do I mean by this? As things stand, it is open to Malta to provide for other kinds of golden visas. You can have a golden residence permit scheme whereby people pay some money, and after they stay for 4 or 5 years in the member state, then they become eligible for nationality. So there are ways, in other words, of member states achieving much or some of what they want to achieve through alternative means. And in that sense, they can absorb the adverse consequences of the ruling. If the court had found the other way, then I think it would have been much more difficult for the EU to absorb the adverse consequences of the commercialization of union citizenship. There would be very little for the EU that could do. So that is a non-legal argument, a consequentialist argument that perhaps could be used to defend the judgment. But I still have some difficulty with the reasoning of the court. It talks about citizenship as giving rise to a diplomatic and consular representation, as enabling participation in the democratic life of the Union. But of course, granting nationality of a member state gives rise to all that. And it is for the member state to decide which people should have the benefit of its consular representation, which people should have the right to vote in the national territory. I don't think it is for the Court of Justice to tell member states how to do it. The fact that Article 20 makes the acquisition of union citizenship, the status of union citizenship, dependent on the existence of member state nationality, does not authorize, to my mind, the court or the EU to tell member states what are the conditions for the acquisition of their own nationality. However, union citizenship exists in the plane of EU law. It is an EU law concept. And I think it is well within the court's jurisdiction to decide under what circumstances union citizenship rights can be exercised. And the court has also told us that there is a general principle against abuse of rights, against circumvention. It did that in the Cousins case in relation to tax, but it told us it is a general principle. And I can see that there could be circumstances where the acquisition of nationality of a member state under conditions which do not appear to suggest that there is a real link with the European Union may be seen as an abuse. So, to my mind, it would not have been impossible. I think I say it a bit tentatively because I need to work out more the implications of my argument. So I said it a bit tentatively. I think a lot more thought ought to have been given as to whether it would be possible to separate the two. The fact that someone has acquired the nationality of a member state does not automatically lead to the right to exercise the rights that flow from union citizenship. At that point, it is legitimate for the court to make the distinction. Now, you may well ask, how would there are two, among others, two objections to this. One is, well, how can you then distinguish? There will be two kinds of Maltese citizens. Well, the answer to that is a problem for Malta. It is not actually a problem for the Court of Justice. Some states outside the European Union that operate these golden passport schemes do have different passports. I view it more as a technical problem rather than as an issue that denies the validity of my argument. Second point, how does one compromise this with Article 20, which says that if you have the citizenship of the nationality of a member state, you acquire union citizenship? Well, the simple answer is you compromise it a lot easier than you compromise with the wording of Article 20, what the court did. And again, I would put I would say what I said earlier: union citizenship exists purely in the plane of European Union law, over which the Court of Justice very legitimately has control. What you control is the exercise of rights. The right may be automatic, but its exercise may be subject to this constraint of that flows from the prohibition of abuse. Now, I don't think the solution that I'm proposing is excluded from the judgment. The court simply did not deal with this. And consider the following hypothetical. I don't know what Malta has done following the judgment of the court. But let us suppose for a minute that a member state in the position of Malta now passes a law which says to the people who acquired its citizenship, its nationality, via the Golden Passport Scheme, well, you continue to be a Maltese national because we promised you that, but you are not allowed to exercise union citizenship rights. So suppose that Malta did that, and suppose that one, a member of that group of citizens, challenged this limitation before a Maltese court, then the Maltese court could make reference to the Court of Justice, and then we would find out if, in the view of the Court of Justice, this arrangement by, in this hypothetical arrangement by Malta, was compatible with EU law. If the court said it was compatible with EU law, then that opens the road for the solution that I have proposed. So I'm putting it tentatively. I think a lot more thought should be given to it. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And sorry to have cut you off in your prime, but that was absolutely fascinating. And we're very fortunate to have you here to make that point. You very kindly made the point to me a couple of months ago when we met. And I think it's absolutely fascinating, one I've not heard before. So thank you. And if you've got to go to teach, please feel free to leave us.
I will leave in 5 minutes. It's the purpose of this, of my participation, is not to listen to me. The purpose really was to listen to you and ask.
Thank you. Thanks a million. Amelia.
Well, I'm not as nearly informed as the two previous speakers on the case. So I'll give only my very.
Can you hear? Okay. All right. Can you hear her?
Yeah.
Thanks. Go ahead, Amelia.
So I'll give my sort of understanding of the case and also bring the dimension of the origins of the European citizenship and how does that play perhaps into the arguments made by the court. Now, it seems to me that the central debate in Commission versus Malta is, of course, commercialization, transactional nature, but also the conceptualization of the genuine link requirement. And there is this divergence of opinions as to whether there is a genuine link requirement under international law and then under EU law. And as a general matter, this area is in general creating a more controversial debate globally, not just within the EU, especially in the increasing passportization policies of countries. Now, Republic of Malta and Advocate General Collins are saying, well, genuine link is just one of the possible criteria for naturalization. So a state whose sovereign domain is to decide these things can either include it or not. Whether that is really the case is a very complex question. International law does not provide us a very clear answer to that. Notable case, which the court cites, does not talk about it. It's about recognition of another state's naturalization, grant of nationality, but not about the limits of that conferral of nationality. So we don't know really from that case. There are different opinions. Scholars like Ian Brownlee or James Crawford will suggest that it does, genuine link does arise from the general principles of international law, but it's a gray area. What we do know in this case is that it's undisputed that it's for the member states to decide how they grant this nationality. And it's also undisputed that by operating the investor citizenship scheme, Malta did not include genuine link requirement in its investment scheme. Now, The Commission and the Corps, on the other hand, do not view genuine link as one of the possible requirements. They view it as something completely fundamental embedded in the concept of union citizenship. And because union citizenship derives from national granting of citizenship, they are interlinked. So I read this as slightly different to what the previous speakers were saying in terms of just completely separating. It's a Maltese problem. Well, the court says they are linked. One derives from another. And because union citizenship is part of the special framework of the EU, it's very specific to the EU. They're leaving the question of international law aside. Union citizenship is a fundamental component of EU integration. And because of that, they, under principle of sincere cooperation, have to not take any action that would destroy that nature of the union citizenship as a drive for integration. Now, how do we assess this position of the court? One of the ways to do so, perhaps, would be to look at the origins of union citizenship. Why was union citizenship introduced? Is it really that fundamental part of integration? Citizenship was introduced under the Maastricht Treaty in 1992. And the story goes that it was introduced very last minute by Spanish governmental proposal, but actually it's not the case. It's a very long lasting project of two decades prior to Maastricht Treaty. And citizenship, to summarize it very briefly, I don't want to take 10 minutes, was an idea that was developed in the project of European Union. The idea in the 70s was, okay, if we want to create the European Union, we need to create the feeling of identity in European Union. We need to legitimize this project. And how can we do it? Well, one of the ways to do that would be to make union closer to the citizens, to this belongingness feeling. And to do that, the idea of union citizenship as a unifying factor was developed. Then the idea of giving special rights, political rights, free movement rights, passport union was created. So union citizenship in that sense has that angle of being really the driving component. The purpose of it was to drive integration. Now, that feeling of belongingness then is crucial, it's essential, and member states agreed that this is why European citizenship is introduced. And if member states are the gatekeepers of that union citizenship, perhaps that should be taken into consideration. Now, does belongingness and does a feeling of belongingness mean the same as a genuine link? That I don't know. And I guess that remains an open question. Is it the same to say that we want to create people's union, we want citizens to feel part of the union, we want them to feel part of this integration process? Is that the same as to require an genuine link? That I will leave as an open question.
Thank you very much indeed. Marcus?
Yes. As someone who has worked on what I call Europe's second constitution, I'm very interested in the federalizing nature of the Malta judgment. Right, because in a certain way, as Daniel and Takis and Emilio just alluded to, it resets the relationship between the federal level and the member state level. And I find that fascinating. Unlike previous speakers, I think it was the right judgment. I think it, if anything, the original sin was in Rotman, where the court very clearly said, yes, citizenship is an exclusive competence of the member states, but even in areas of exclusive competences of the member states, EU law still fulfills a function. It's a shadow of EU law that we need to take into account, right? In Rotman, they called this the genuine enjoyment of EU citizenship, which would be taken away. In the Malta judgment, they call it notions of solidarity. But for me, granting citizenship and withdrawing citizenship is not fundamentally different. And I know some commentators have said, well, but in one, you use citizenship to augment fundamental rights, to increase the rights of the citizen by helping them to keep the citizenship. And in the other, you do exactly the opposite. In my view, the granting and withdrawal of citizenship must follow similar rights. And of course, fundamental rights need to be taken into account. So I wouldn't be surprised if in the next iteration, it's not the commercialization of citizenship, it's the Austrian approach to 18 years of residency before you can even look at citizenship that comes under scrutiny. Because what we've seen, I think, in the court, and here, in my view, the court acts a little bit like a constitutional court, right? It looks at the constitutional structure and argues on first principles, maybe a bit thin in the detail of the argument. I find it a little bit disappointing that, for example, international law didn't play a much greater role, because it would have been very helpful. But by and large, when it comes to the rights protection, I wouldn't be surprised if the court looks at all the member state laws and cuts across and says 18 years residency is excessive. 8 years is maybe the middle, and no residency, like in Malta, is clearly not allowed, right? So it opens up, perhaps, to ask where are the limits of discretion for member states in the exercise of exclusive competences of the member states. And as we see with all forms of discretion, there are limits, especially if they have an impact on the rest of the Union and maybe some of the European values.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your position. Martin.
Thank you all. So I, in terms of what I, whether I think it's a good case or a bad case, I personally have not made my mind up yet. But I think I'm going to slightly disagree with the interesting points by Professor Gehring. I'm going to make three brief points. Firstly, I think we are in the realm of competence extension again. And I think that this is something that needs to be somewhat highlighted. Secondly, I come from the background, actually, of citizenship, and I'm currently publishing in Solidarity. So I'm interested in the role of rhetoric in judicial construction, and whether that matters. And then the notion of solidarity itself. I think, you know, Professor Gehring, in a different context, has referred to whether it's elaborating potentially an empty concept from the case. Just in terms of this issue of competence itself, I think it is worth pointing out, and Professor Sarmiento pointed this out, obviously, in his context representing Malta as well, the opinion of Advocate General Collins. I think on one level, you could suggest that the cases that have been alluded to, regardless as to the points that have just been made, I still think they could be distinguished. If there's an attempt to bring in fundamental rights, for instance, this is very, very different from the Chen situation. It's very, very different from the Rotman situation. But since I've published an entire book on this, I think it's interesting to note the other types of authority that the Courts of Justice has used. They go back to the old law on Micheletti. I think that also deals with a slightly different situation. And there's this reference to bedrock from the Commission in Belgium case, but that dealt with being employed in the core civil service, and that was simply repeated in the Laurie Bloom case on the worker. So in my view, in terms of the authority that the court was using for the propositions they were making, I think they could be distinguished. And the only case that I could think of by comparison was the core case, which dealt with the British overseas passports issue. And of course, the ruling from the Court of Justice was the exact opposite. The second point I'm going to just briefly make is this of judicial construction. it's noticeable, I think Professor Sarmiento made this point, so did Professor Tridimas, that we are now going from the rhetoric of destiny to the rhetoric of something being constituted, or maybe a constitution. This is going to be repeated again and again by the courts, as well as this new dynamic of whether it's possible or not to commercialize EU citizenship. This is a bold and innovative statement by the court that I'm sure it will return to again and again and again. On the issue of solidarity, this is the thing I found quite interesting. So the court says that union citizenship is thus one of the principal concrete expressions of solidarity. But something I'm thinking about quite a lot is, what does that mean? Well, on one level, it refers in paragraph 96 to this essentially being the interrelationship between member states and nationals that form the bedrock of nationality. In other words, this is a solidarity that is to be expressed between an individual and the state, and therefore can feed into these arguments that they haven't been resident on the territory long enough, etc. But then the court somewhat changes tack, and in it further refers to the relationship between the member states and good faith. And it's noticeable that it refers to solidarity and good faith, what, four or five times. And I think this is the issue that I find particularly interesting, because essentially the court is making the argument that it's breaking down that relationship of trust and good faith between the member states. So this is a constitutional point. And that Malta manifestly disregarded its relationship by commercializing citizenship. But I think that, and this is therefore a breach of the principle of sincere cooperation. But I think this is something that needs to be explored rather than presumed. So we're therefore presuming, based on what I put as non-evidence, that this could have implications in the relationships between member states, that Malta has somehow broken that level of trust between it and the member states and between it and the EU institutions. And I think it's something that perhaps needs to be explored a bit more rather than presumed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That is absolutely fascinating. I love the diversity of takes on all of this. Daniel, do you want to come back on anything? And I'm going to then briefly open the floor. We've got 10 minutes. We have to finish at 2 o'clock precisely. Daniel, do you want to come back on any points? You're on mute, just so you remind them.
Yes. Thank you. Those were very interesting contributions to this discussion. I in 3 or 4 minutes, I'll try to address as many things as I can. There's way too much. On Takis's comments on this distinction or this category of exercise of rights, which might have been a solution, I have a problem with that, because I think that that could collide in a very essential or very fundamental way with the court's approach towards exercise of rights, particularly Micheletti. This notion that Takis is purporting, I think at some point would need some Micheletti refining, because the court was quite clear in stating that, well, once you have nationality, you're exercising free movement, and it's not for the other member states to review or to question the consequences of the attribution of nationality. So I see Takis's point, but I think that that would have to come along with some Micheletti refining of some sorts, or otherwise, and Kaur refining of some sorts. Otherwise, I see it problematic. There were other ways to tackle this. I think that there were. A different story is whether they were politically feasible or more inconvenient. But what is the problem? The real practical problem of purchases of citizenship, according to the European Commission, the real practical problem is that creates risks of a variety of kinds, from money laundering to corruption to finance of terrorism. But also that creates problems with third countries, because nationals who have access to this type of nationality exercising visa exemption rights, for example, in third countries, in the United States, for example. That can create a series of bilateral problems for the EU. These are all very practical problems, and all of them have a solution under EU legislation, because the EU has competence to regulate all these subject matters. So I think that the actual problems in terms of mutual trust and cooperation between member states and the collateral consequences, the externalities produced by these programs, could have been addressed from multiple policy angles. The Commission did not want to look at this case from that perspective, and they made a principal point, and the court bought that point. But I think that there were alternatives which could have ended up in a probably similar position, because eventually, if that is really the problem, eventually the demand for these types of products in the market would disappear. If eventually there are all these requirements attached to an application of this type. Emilia mentioned the genuine link, and I agree that there is a rationale of genuine link in the somewhere in the underground of the judgment. But the genuine link is not mentioned once in the reasoning of the judgment, not a single time. Instead of the genuine link, we have the court calls the special relationship of solidarity and good faith between the states and its nationals and the reciprocity of rights and duties. That is the genuine link, I would say. My interpretation is the court distanced itself very consciously from the debate on the genuine link in international law. The court didn't want to go down that road. And the exchanges between the parties, which were very heated on what's the status of the genuine link, I think it convinced the court that that was not the way to go forward. And that's reflected in the opinion of the Advocate General, who focused on this particular point, because that was the point made by the Commission. The Commission's construction of the genuine link, which was the parameter for the review of the framework, was disregarded by the court. And the court construed a new one. That's one of my frustrations here, because we never really had a chance to discuss about this new parameter, but the court came up with it. I really don't think that this parameter has a specific content by now. I must say, though, that it doesn't come out of the blue. This is the definition that the court used in previous deprivation of nationality cases, particularly when the court agreed with the member state on the content of those rules on deprivation of nationality. And the court used to say nationality is a special, and it described nationality in this way. The step forward taken in Malta is that that description of the bond of nationality has become normative, has turned from descriptive in the court's case law into normative now, and that is the genuine link. So I would put my money on this term, on the special relationship, as the future of the genuine link. On Marcus's comment on the future of review of nationality laws, indeed, with Commission Malta, a member state introducing a residence requirement of 18 years, could come under the scrutiny. But I think that we are going to be facing the opposite situations in the future. A member state that decides to grant nationality on too generous grounds for descendancy, unlimited ascendancy, as has been, for example, until recently, of Italian nationality laws, that's the kind of profile of rule that might come under fire. The attribution of nationality on the connections of ascendance to a non-conflict, like the Spanish Civil War, for example, unlimited. And we have close to 500,000 applications now in multiple Latin American countries, 500,000 applications for Spanish nationality. Those cases of extremely generous conditions of access to nationality, I think, are the ones which will become problematic. But if both will become problematic, this means that Commission Malta has definitely opened a Pandora's box. And my doubt is whether the Commission really wants to go down that road. And my feeling is that it does not. And the type of discussions we might have in the future might show the Commission as a much more reluctant interlocutor with the court in these types of cases. And I would also add that if there is an emerging consensus on the member states at the time, there are not many of them at the time, but there is one, and that is that immigration is very important for the member states. And I wouldn't be surprised that if we go down this road with a very, very, very very groundbreaking and a very broad degree of scrutiny on the part of the court on the conditions of acquisition of nationality going in any of those two directions, I wouldn't be surprised if at some point the member states said, basta, it's over. As we said in Declaration Number 2 in 1992, this is for us to decide. And that's a dangerous road, also for the court. And that's why the Commission, I think, will be a very reluctant interlocutor here. And one last point, what Martin was mentioning about the reciprocity between the member states, I think this is the result of the Commission introducing sincere cooperation as a joint ground of review. That the Commission's plea was based on a violation of Article 21 and Article 4.3. I think Article 4.3 was introduced there because the Commission was aware of how weak its argument was just solely in Article 20, so it had to introduce other elements there. I think that's the result in the judgment of the introduction of sincere cooperation. In my view, the arguments produced in terms of how that cooperation can be undermined are very, very weak. Because it's purely declaratory as to what those risks are, what the problems actually are. At the present moment, there are multiple limitations on political rights for free-moving individuals. We are all familiarized with the case law. So the degree of cooperation that's shown by the member states by their national rules introducing restrictions on free-moving individuals and EU nationals is quite significant. I don't understand really why this is so spectacularly different to what we find in other areas. And I would just add as my last comment, do you know how many member states intervened in these proceedings in support of the Commission, concerned by the implications and the externalities that the Maltese program entailed for their own interests? There were zero member states intervening there. The Commission litigated this entirely alone. Of course, this doesn't mean necessarily that the member states agreed with Malta, but it also shows that member states are concerned, but they are also aware that many of their own measures can raise similar equivalent reciprocal concerns on the other member states. So that's something that I think that the court should have fine-tuned much, much more to make it an effective argument. Otherwise, to me, it sounds very, very hollow.
Thank you so much. That was really absolutely fascinating. And thank you very much for bringing the perspective of the actual inside the courtroom, but also for your academic overview. I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, our time is up. I promised 2 minutes to we'd finish at 2 and that we would leave this room. I wanted to give a huge thanks to all of you for your really insightful comments. Thank you very much indeed, and particularly to Daniel for joining us from Madrid. Thank you.